Look at the planet on the right going down in frame. Look at the ship as we're going through it. Look at the girl as we hear Early's voice. I want to do a commentary on the episode for you here, but I'm not going to do it exactly the way I've been doing it. I'd like to try and explain how this episode came to be a little more specifically than I usually do, since it's kind of an odd one. It's one of my favorites that I ever shot, but not normal. So hopefully there will be some extremely witty anecdotal stuff about what we did on that day and how that guy messed up his lines and how Nathan split his pants again. But in the meanwhile, I may go off picture sometimes just to take you through the process of coming up with this episode and what it means to me. The first thing I need to talk about is Summer, who luckily is on the screen right now as I say that. Summer Glau, who I met when she did Angel. She is a ballerina and played one on Angel, and that's how I got to know her as an actress. Summer in this is very much almost a formal device, and nothing is more important in this episode than her feet, because we're going to be talking a lot about the way she relates to this ship physically. And as a dancer, you can see very well how she moves and how she expresses physically, with her entire body, what she's feeling emotionally. And the connection between those two things is very important. I'm enormously impressed by what she did in this. Things like coming down the stairs here, which I had not even noticed when I was shooting. I only saw it in the edit, how she experiences coming down those stairs. It's a very big deal. She's also important because this episode was designed to be about River, to start dealing with the story of River, what we're seeing. Obviously, our psychic visions of things we've either heard or don't yet understand. We're seeing the teaser through her perspective, which is somewhat disassociative from reality. That's very important for what I ended up trying to say with this episode. But first, let's just talk about how this episode came to be at all, which was me knowing that I wanted to do an episode where River became a part of the group and really had no ideas. Just an embarrassing lack of ideas, or a thundering ton of ideas that, quite frankly, didn't come together at all. Spent a long time working on it, nothing. Finally called Tim Myer in the morning. I said, "Tim, I'm dying here. I got this idea, I got that idea. What do you think? Is this good? Is it fun?" He said, "Boba Fett." And I'd like to stress that he didn't say Boba Fett. This is a man who has dressed up like Logan at conventions, still couldn't say Boba Fett right. In fact, we started calling him Bobby Fett after a while because we were also embarrassed about Tim's mistake. However, those two words, mispronounced though they may have been, brought me to this episode in a way that I, hey feet, never thought possible, because like our Mrs. Reynolds, all he did was throw the pebble in the pond. Give me the ripples. And those are the best episodes of a show like this. Take one extraordinarily strong element, in this case a preternaturally cool, nearly psychic bounty hunter who is able to board their ship from the middle of space and mess with the entire crew, and see what it has to say about our people when you add that element. Now, to get back to River and her feet, Summer, of course, can do a shot like that, which is one of my favorite shots I ever shot, because she's a ballerina. And the idea of creating a balletic sort of whimsical space is another example of her mind. And now she's talking about an object. And what's interesting about that object is, A, that she doesn't recognize it for what it is. So she has taken the meaning of the thing away from the thing to the world outside, that means that she's like a child with a gun. But it actually means a great deal more than that, which she is unable to explain to them. Because she is a little crazy. But it's very important that her experience of that gun was that it was something benign and not even a weapon, not even anything except, you know, part of the nature of her brain. She is very much a part of everything she touches, even while she can't seem to experience it or explain it exactly. Much as I can't seem to explain her. So what I'm going to do after our delightful opening credits is go back even further than the history of trying to make this episode to talk about my favorite thing, the history of me. But first, our delightful opening credits. And I will tell you something anecdotal that I don't believe I've mentioned before here, which is that this song I actually wrote before I wrote the pilot. The day I pitched the show, I went home and wrote this song. I wanted to write a little blues song about what it was like to lose the war and either die, be taken up into heaven, or go out into space and abandon humanity, which is sort of what Mal did. So that's where the song came from. It informed the show I was going to write before I'd ever written it, which was a lot of fun. It helped crystallize things for me. It helped me break into the script. And there it is. Now we're going to see The Great Bounty Hunter with his great musical theme that Greg wrote very specifically. I was like, let's go Once Upon a Time in the West. She has a theme. We agreed on violin. He gave me either a bassoon or an oboe for early here to make him, you know. I was looking for Once Upon a Time in the West. I kind of got Peter and the Wolf. It gives him a kind of almost a fairy story quality, which I like very much. Now let's go back in time to me when I'm 16. It was at that age that I became old enough to realize that I had no faith. And very soon after that, I had what I can very pretentiously describe as an existential epiphany. And I had it sort of almost embarrassingly, yet somehow appropriately, during a Spielberg movie. I was in London by myself during a school break in the fall when I watched Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the special edition, and something in me kind of snapped. I started to think for the first time in an adult fashion about life, about time, about reality, about dying, about all of the things that are right there in front of us every day, but that as children and often as adults we take for granted or find some easy explanation for if we can. In my case, I was presented with the totality of things, but with no coherent pattern to put them in. I just suddenly understood that real life was happening. A friend of mine, soon after, when I got back to school and tried to describe this experience, gave me the most important book I ever read, which was Jean-Paul Sartre's Nausea. And apart from that and a little bit of The Myth of Sisyphus by Camus, I really haven't read extensively about existentialism or absurdism. I don't want to paint myself as an intellectual. I really don't know anything about philosophy. But I did know that this book spoke to what I believe more accurately and totally than anything I had ever read. And what it talked about was the pain of being aware of things and their existence outside of their meaning, just the very fact of objects in space that we cannot stop existence and we cannot stop change, that we have to accept these things. And again, if we see no grand plan in them, we have to accept them as existing completely on their own and existing totally. part of what that means, I can't really explain. I do know there's a passage in the book that says, nothing can exist only slightly. And the protagonist is so overwhelmed by this fact, the fact that every piece of paper he picks up off the ground exists so completely, is so much there, it actually makes him nauseous. It makes his stomach hurt. It's too intense. For me, it has a kind of rapture to it. And I find meaning in objects to be a beautiful thing because I have no plan to put them in. I find the meaning of the object to be within the object, both in however it's functional and the fact of its existence. A ball is to be thrown, but it's also just a round thing. The reason I pointed out the planet at the beginning is because we're going to see that again at the end. The image is mirrored with the Super Bowl that the girls are playing jacks with. I did that very deliberately as a sort of classic object in space, a ball, a round thing in motion going through the frame. Now, right here, we're going through the ship again to what is my favorite shot, River listening. This shot here, the Batgirl shot, as I call it, I had to shoot four times before I found the right angle. The point of the scene, story-wise, is that they are being listened to below and above by two people who are outsiders, who hear everything they're saying, but and can understand it on a level that even they can't, since she is psychic and he is so intuitive as to be nearly psychic, yet they also can't understand a great deal of it, because it is just, there's a synapse in them that is broken. And again, I mentioned the fact that we go through the ship, and I mentioned that at the beginning. The reason for that, that's something people can do now, and they do it a lot. You see it in, you know, CSI or Panic Room or anything like that. We have the technology. But it's not something I would ever have done on Firefly, except in this episode. And that's because I wanted to connect the reality of the ship with particularly River and the people in it. Because as becomes apparent later, River assumes the identity of the ship. She actually becomes the object. Now, the godship is a concept that's been in science fiction, Frank Herbert, even 2001. The ship, you know, that is more powerful than, and perhaps more knowing than the people in it. It's a great science fiction theme. But what I'm trying to do with it is obviously something a little bit different. I'm just trying to get the audience to see people who are relating to the space, the objects, only on that level. Because ultimately, what I'm saying about them is that they do have meaning, and it's the meaning we bring to them. And that's what makes us so extraordinary. What makes objects so extraordinary is the fact of them, the very fact of them. It's mind-boggling. I believe that whether you have faith or not, to think about consciousness, our ability to understand that these things exist, and to think about the fact of existence.
What do we plan to do about this?
Well, that's the question.
I don't think she'd ever hurt.
But what's equally extraordinary is our ability to, and I use this word specifically in the show, imbue them with meaning. And not just with function, that is to say we make a gun is for a thing, that's something else that Early himself brings up, but to imbue them with meaning the way River imbues the gun with a different meaning than Early does. And I didn't notice when I was writing it that they were both dealing very specifically with guns. I don't like guns myself. Obviously, this is an action show, and it's also a Western, and people shoot at each other. And it's really cool for them. Summer herself, the first time she got to shoot those three guys, she had quite an out-of-body experience. What the hell? It's fun. But the fact of the matter is that they are grotesque in their function. So the idea that River sees in them something beyond the idea of a weapon makes her a good person. And ultimately, that's what this episode does with her and Early. It says, these two people are the same. They are outsiders. They experience things the same way. They're not these guys. I mean, Kaylee, who breaks my heart in this scene every time, because she is so the person who just believes and has faith and gets hurt and is decent, and you feel what she feels. River and, oh, thank you very much, book. Way to ruin the kiss. You know, we got canceled. They never got to kiss. Okay, fine, whatever. Kaylee is, you know, an emotional in for us. She's like the narrator. We feel what she feels. Not the same for River, but this episode was designed to show that even though she may have been designed for killing, because she clearly killed those three guys, what separates her from somebody from, like, Early is her heart. That she takes the meaninglessness of things or the disassociative way of looking at them and imbues them with a kindness, even though she may be violent and strange and unpredictable. Whereas Early, who also appreciates things on a very tactile level. Also, Early's feet getting some play. Just what we're walking on. Very important. Even though he does that, he brings pain. He brings evil. He thinks of himself as above the pain that he inflicts. But in fact, as River points out later on, he's bringing the darkness. He's enjoying it. So what he brings to the party, however his perspective may mirror River's, is the opposite of what she does. And it's through understanding that that the crew finally accepts her. And one of the interesting things about how Early deals with people, and this is something that I didn't even realize as I was writing it. My wife pointed it out, as she often makes me articulates things that I've done and don't know I've done, is that Early has a very specific way of dealing with every character on the ship. He has listened to their conversation, so we understand he knows enough about them. And he understands that when you are with Mal, you have to take him out instantly, because Mal is a physical threat that is very real. And then, you know, he closes up Jane and Zoe and all the threats. Kaylee's... I loved decorating Kaylee's little bunk. I thought that would be so great. Kaylee is someone that he approaches a different way, through a really horrible form of sexual intimidation. This is one of those scenes that, you know, you write and then you worry that maybe you're not as good a person as you hoped you were. You film this scene and everybody kind of wants to avoid you for the rest of the day. It really is just as creepy as possible. Later on, we'll see him dealing with Book, and we'll see him dealing with Simon. He deals with Book again. This guy has to be taken out, which gives us a little insight into Book's character. That isn't something I realized when I wrote it. And of course, he deals with Simon with logic, because he understands that the best way to deal with Simon is through logic, because that's the kind of person he is.
Maybe I come down the chimney, Kaylee.
Richard Brooks, and I'll come back to him as a performer, right here, this bit, when he says, maybe I've always been here. One of the great things about making a show is the collaborative effort that you have with actors. And Richard was, I guess I'm talking about him now, extraordinary. and understood what I was trying to do, which I explained to him and to Summer, just the way they were going to relate to the space, the why they were talking about it, or the way they were in it. He gave that line, "Maybe I've always been here," in a different way than I wrote it. He said it as though he wasn't sure he hadn't always been there. And my heart nearly stopped when I saw that, because I hadn't meant to do it that way. He was just supposed to be talking. But his belief that maybe he had was so perfect for the character. It was a great example of the work extending beyond what you hope. Now,
I'm gonna give you a present. Get rid of a problem you've
got. I want to talk about Jewel again, because how can you not? She did this scene beautifully two times, and then I went up to her and said, "Okay, those were great. Now, give me everything. Go too far. Put it all right on the surface." And she said, "Great. Actors don't get that note a lot. That's fun." And the last take is the only one we used, because she didn't, her version of too far, putting everything on the surface, especially that moment there, is so achingly perfect and beautiful and painful. I can't say enough about her as a performer. I really just was amazed by what she did there. That she just had that in her, and she was keeping it back because she thought I wouldn't want all of it.
Hello?
So let's go back for a sec to the process of writing this. Having figured out that I was going to put Bobby Fed on the ship, I was having some trouble figuring out what would happen. It's a very simple story, which means, quite frankly, not that much happens. So, every moment, his journey through the ship is kind of crucial. So what you just saw, him sliding down, what you're about to see, him getting all spidery on the top of the ceiling, these are all things that I went and did because I was having trouble figuring out his progress through the ship. And the great thing about TV... another one of them is that you have the sets, and very often you can just go onto the set and write there. I'm not going to point out that Sean looks really good with his shirt off, but I'm sure some of you may have noticed that. I got many, many, many thanks for adding this shirtless scene to the show. I'm not above some cheesecake. I, having had some trouble, went onto the set, which, as you know, is built contiguously. The entire top half and the entire bottom half exist. So when you're on that ship, you're really on that ship. You go down those stairs, you're really going down those stairs. And so I sort of worked the physicality of where he would go, which I've done before on the Buffy set, but what was different, in a sense, than anything that had ever been. This is a very important point he's bringing up about the room, about the meaning of the thing. If she's not using it, does it have the same meaning? And of course, he's leaving Simon well behind with this concept, just because it's a little odd to bring up at such a desperate time, but that's Early's whole thing. Walking through the set, for me, was a very tactile experience. It was about climbing up on things and using the set. In a way, that banister wasn't made to slide on. Those ladders weren't made to hide on. The banister that River earlier on is standing on so that she can get near the ceiling and listen to what's going on upstairs wasn't meant for that. But these people don't take objects at face value.
Maybe she does, but you don't know.
And that's what I was starting to talk about when I talked about The Myth of Sisyphus by Camus. He talks about the walls coming away, reality revealing itself beyond our understanding of, what we have shaped those walls to be. My house, my room. In this case, the walls, he mentions how they go out. They literally go away. They do create a particular open feeling, and being on that set, you have that feeling. And for the artist, I know that it's a set, and that it's beyond it is just a stage. So it has a kind of fragility. And I want the audience to have that same kind of fragility because beyond it is space. And one of the things that I learned, and this was also pointed out by my wife Kai, the extraordinary fragility of things is revealed by how we go through them so specifically. It's also revealed, that is to say, him going ship to ship, breaking in. We understand, you know, how trapped these people are. How these walls are open to them, yet, you know, God forbid they should actually open. They to them, it would mean death. To me, it would mean the intrusion of reality on my fiction.
Not killed.
So, to go on a little bit more about Early, this is an example of what I love about the character of Early. His knowledge, that's not a shepherd, not based on, you know, anything he read in a file, not even having actually really seen the guy very carefully, just intuiting that this was a man, and we've seen Book beat up a cop that needs to be taken out physically.
Tortured her. A teenage girl. Not some bandit on a murder run.
And what he says here to Simon is, I think, kind of valid. He has interesting perspectives on things, which I really appreciate. Now, writing this character, you know, you bring in a sort of larger-than-life, or in this case, stranger-than-fiction kind of villain, you you have to find their voice. And for me, that process took a few things. It took, obviously, the idea of matching him with River. That was one thing. I have to say, a big influence, I had recently watched The Minus Man, with Owen Wilson giving, I'd say, the only convincing portrait of a serial killer I've seen since Michael Rooker's. He had a very serene kind of cheerfulness about him. As he went around killing people. But there was something horribly violent in him. And this obviously, by the way, is the sort of heart of the beast in terms of the meaning, and I just think it's beautifully, beautifully shot. Good old David Boyd. But anyway, that was sort of in my head to an extent, that kind of, again, disassociative, but not angry violence. And another portion was that while I was walking through on this very platform, trying to figure out these pieces, including this, which is, you know, one of my other favorite moments in the show, because when I say that he and River experience things in a more tactile fashion, I take it to a completely absurd level here, and I love that. While I was doing this, a security guard came. And we sort of ran around the ship for what was literally 5 minutes trying to find each other because it was all so closed off. He didn't know why I was there on a Saturday, so I had to explain. And I had never met him. Great big fella, and he just kind of started talking about the show. They're going to let you finish? How's it going? You know, it's a pretty interesting show. And as he was leaving, he was just, you know, just have faith in yourself. You'll be fine. Kind of walked off. It was bizarre. It was a little it was a little bit of Early. He just kind of sort of walked through things, and that kind of was the last thing to click, you know, with everything else that I had in my head. He sort of helped me find that character. There was one more thing to be found, and that, of course, was Richard Brooks, who is extraordinary. And the moment I heard he was auditioning, I got excited. But to watch him do it, the conviction with which he does everything, the extraordinary dry wit, the way he gives things like, am I a lion? And lines like this. He was just a treasure. We got very lucky with our guest stars. Nathan and I have said that. Never more so than with Richard, who, you know, owns the screen for a good portion of the time, and he and Sean had a great time together. Because it was a side of Sean we hadn't gotten to see. Really, he's very sardonic and witty and kind of, you know, kind of in control of the situation. So, you know, I can't say enough about the two of them, and particularly about Richard, who, you know, also knew all his lines, which, believe it or not, is, you know, also a big factor with a guest star. But, you know, ready to try. And when I walked him around the ship, as I did with Summer, and she said previously, I love Nathan going a little cross-eyed there. He's always completely in the moment, our Nathan is. She's mentioned that I played her some music, which may have been the last factor in sort of figuring out this episode, was the score to Gattaca, which I listened to incessantly while I wrote. I happened on it. I'd used it before, but I hadn't listened to it for a while. And I actually played some of it for Summer while we were shooting as a way of expressing how she as an actress was making me feel as a director, an extraordinary amount of emotion that I couldn't quite define, and my inability to define what it is that I'm dealing with is kind of the most important part of it, and I apologize for that, but there it is. I love this sequence because it creates a lovely arc for the two of them, however much Jewel may have hated lying on the grating, because River, of whom she was afraid, now gives her the strength to confront something more fearsome. And that's how we get them back together, which I love. The very first time River speaks, we hear her voice as though she's in the room with them. And that was done. And then in the second time, you can hear that it's the intercom. That was Lisa Lasek, the editor. She said, I've tried a little something. I hope you like it. And Lisa always brings something to the party. And that was a brilliant idea because, again, the idea of experiencing an object and the idea of becoming an object work really well together. And this was early in the series. A lot of people were able to watch this and actually think that she had become a part of the ship. Because they didn't know. We talked about being psychic. They didn't know how far in science fiction we were going to go. The fact of the matter is, psychic was exactly as far as I was prepared to go. She wasn't going to become a ship. But the idea that you might believe it makes you look at the ship in a new way. It makes you understand her in a different way. And that's what I was, you know, trying to get at in a large way, besides just having a lot of fun.
You're a liar. I don't think your intentions are honorable.
No, I'm a bounty hunter.
So I bring up the fact that the editor, Lisa, made it sound like she was in the room. The fact is, she was when we shot all of these scenes. For all of her off camera, she was sitting on an apple box right on set, giving the lines that they, you know, would have something to react to. Richard did the same thing for her when we go to his ship. He did all his off camera for her right there. It really helped, especially when things get emotional, to have her right there. And then we had to re-record some of it. You know, we had to go through all her lines, but the fact is, she's just off camera during all of these shots. There with us. And here's where we see Early start to lose control of the situation in a meaningful way, when he actually begins to believe she might be the ship. And you know, this is you know, my big problem is when I try and make a show about a bunch of people and that isn't about an adolescent superhero. You inevitably make a show about an adolescent superhero, and at least this episode was. And the fact that the captain is peevish with her, yet a little intimidated by her in one of the cutest exchanges, when he gives that look and she calls him on it. And then ultimately does what she says, just as Kaylee does. The fact that the captain is willing to do that, you know, shows both that she's being accepted and that he's cool and decent. And, you know, turns this into, you know, one of my classic stories. This is possibly my favorite exchange that I've ever written. I'm not even going to talk during it.
This girl is the smallest cargo I've ever had to transport, yet by far the most troublesome. Does that seem right to you?
What'd you do?
Who?
The midget.
Arson. Little man loved fire.
Sorry. I just love that. Gotta give it up for Richard Brooks again, because his dry wit and his hypnotic voice such a huge part of this episode.
I can take this guy out.
So, you know, some of you have got to be saying, what's the point? You know, so great. They look at objects differently. That's a great thing. That's an important thing for people to be able to do. Who cares? Apart from the no-touching guns that's repeated from the beginning and the fact that she devises her entire plan so that nobody gets hurt, there's no shooting, even though it doesn't work that way. So there is a kind of morality inherent in what she's doing that is a part of it. The other thing is that that there is no moral. That, like an object in space, this episode exists. It has an emotional arc. It's a story to be told. I'm not going to sit there and lecture to the audience, although I am right now. But hey, you listened. It's not my fault. That it itself is also just an object. Now, on Angel, I made a very similar statement when I had him say, realize that, you know, he couldn't count on the powers that be, that maybe there's no grand plan, and Angel has said, if nothing we do means anything, then the only thing that means anything is what we do. Now that is the moral implication of a universe that has no meaning. This is more the physical implication, and the ability we have to, again, imbue it with meaning, and how glorious or terrifying that is. This little sequence, by the way, you know, we shot the entire sequence of him listening, and then I said, okay, Richard, it's not in the script, but I want you to do me a favor. I'm going to go around with the camera again. Go crazy. React to everything she says as intensely as possible. And he just went to town, and it was wonderful to watch, because he kind of was like, oh, that's a little strange. I'll go there, and he went there, and then he went there even harder. And intercutting those, you know, is, again, you know, it fits the way we make the show. Again, it's something people do all the time nowadays, sort of things not connecting, but in our case, with the specific purpose of showing, you know, a fractured mind. The first time I ever did anything like it, again, was in such a banal and literal sense as this was, which was with Faith in episode 16 of season 4 of Angel, Who Are You?, when she's played by Sarah, when she's freaking out after being told I love you by Riley, I started using different footage and kind of editing it oddly, you know, in a NYPD blue kind of fashion, to give the sense of a fractured mind. So you'll find that while apparently I'm this big philosophical guy, what I am is an incredible pedant. I'm very literal about everything I do. Or literable, if that ever becomes a word. I'll be sure to be that too. We do find emotion, which, by the way, Alan sells really well. Whenever he gets sad, I think, oh no. And the first time Summer was just sitting on an apple box on stage giving this speech, Jane Sekular, the script supervisor, and I, you know, looked at each other, tears welling up in our eyes. She kills me with this, her little strength, and her decency and her aloneness. Aloneness is, and not loneliness, but aloneness is, you know, the most common theme in everything that I feel and do. And hers is so painful. And then there goes Simon ruining her plan. But then we get to have some nice violence. Well, it's an action show, you know. But that speech is a sham, after all. She's lying. She's trying to get early off the ship. At the same time, she's speaking truth and everybody knows it. And it just kind of breaks my heart. You know, she is an extraordinary performer in her own right. And, you know, I've gone on about it. Probably can't enough. This is a callback to the first time we ever saw his wall of guns in the pilot and the big you know. Always adding a little Jane moment is good. He never does the right thing. Always love that about him. Of course, the pilot hadn't aired when this aired the first time, so, but people still got the idea. Can't say enough. I believe Ron Cobb helped design that ship. We spent a long time on it, on his, the ship and his suit. Really wanted that Buck Rogers kind of feel. I mean the strip, not the TV show from the 80s. Really wanted something, you know, awesome and colorful and yet at the same time believable. And that worked out beautifully. This is one of my favorite scenes of Summers. I could never understand why. First of all, she looks like she's filled with joy. She loves space. In fact, she was in a really painful harness that she'd had on through lunch, but she still managed to make it seem fun. I couldn't understand why I loved her in that suit so much until somebody explained. It's like a snowsuit. It's just too big on her. It's like Willow in the Eskimo suit on Buffy. You know, as much as Kaylee is for the audience, Mal is our audience proxy, and so when he loves her and accepts her, we do, even though we already do. Now, starting right there from that screen, this is a great big Steadicam wanner. I don't use a lot of Steadicam on the show. This was partially caused, again, by the score to Gattaca, which takes you along so hypnotically that you want to do shots that go on for a long time. But it's also here for a very specific reason. And the reason is very simply, now the crew is connected. Everybody is connected, and they're all connected to River. And so I wanted to do a shot that encompassed everybody, showed what they're going through here. This is, you know, she's said she's leaving the ship. They're in a very weird space, and just watch the two of them. It's a subtle thing. They both just, whoops, I can't, I shouldn't, I have too much emotion. I love that. Needless to say, this take took a lot of takes because it does encompass everybody and having to go up those really narrow stairs and a lot of difficult Steadicam work. And every time, a couple of times we got to the end and Summer forgot her line or made a mistake and Nathan just brutal shouting, "Summer!" And then we did another take where Nathan blew it right at the beginning. I yelled cut and he just yelled, "Summer!" Oh, he picked on her. He picked on the girls terribly. He's the worst big brother anybody ever had. But now we've gone through that entire shot and seen that at the end of it is River, meaning she's a part of them now. And here we get to the match for the ball, for the planet, that is, with the ball. Held up in frame to really just take a moment to experience it. And feel the connection between it and the ship and the world they're in. And there is no better statement about mankind's fate, or quite frankly, the fate of this show.
Yep. Here I am.
And how we felt while we were filming it than what he just said. So that really worked on two levels. I had something very specific I was trying to do, and I really wanted to share it with you. So I'm sorry that was probably repetitive, incoherent, and not that anecdotal, but I will say just at the end how grateful I am to every single person, every single cast member. They came through and gave me not just one of the happiest filming experiences I ever had, but the chance to say something truly abstract in a story filled with emotion, and, well, that's the best. Thanks. Hope you didn't turn it off.